Hello, I'm Richard Gisbert, and you're at The Listening Post. This week, the mother of all WikiLeaks.
This is the largest leak in military history.
The fallout from the release of military documents on the war in Afghanistan. Rupert Murdoch, The Times of London, and the future of journalism online.
How do we make sure that people pay?
You turn them off.
It took a while, but major U.S. news outlets are finally pushing the Pentagon on the rules of reporting on Guantanamo Bay and iPhone 4.
Excuse me, sir.
The Empire strikes back.
Are you seriously defending the new phone by saying it almost performs as well as the old phone?
The war in Afghanistan was back in the headlines this past week, and a website put it there. WikiLeaks, the online whistleblowing news-generating phenomenon, has dumped what's being called the biggest ever leak of military documents onto the global news agenda. 91,000 classified papers relating to the war in Afghanistan. Just 3 months ago, WikiLeaks made news with the release of that decrypted classified video from 2007, showing U.S. troops firing on civilians in Iraq. This time, the man behind the site, Julian Assange, used a different modus operandi, a different media strategy. Rather than starting out by posting all the documents online, WikiLeaks initially collaborated with three newspapers, the New York Times, The Guardian in the UK, and the German news weekly Der Spiegel. Our starting point this week is the unprecedented leak of U.S. military documents that set the World Wide Web alight, dominated the pages of newspapers, and had airwaves buzzing from Washington to Kabul.
Well, this isn't a WikiLeak, this is a WikiTorrent.
This is something we've never seen before. This is certainly the biggest leak in military history.
We have a lot of good reporting here, good material, good narrative to add to the story on Afghanistan.
If you want to understand what's going on in Afghanistan, this helps you too.
Well, could the classified military documents released by WikiLeaks pose a threat to national security?
Since its launch in 2006, through the posting of millions of documents from thousands of secretive sources, WikiLeaks has revealed much to the world. In releasing the Afghan war logs, the organization revealed something of itself, that it's learning about the media.
I'm intrigued by the relationship between you and the traditional non-advocacy media here.
I think WikiLeaks has developed into an organization that realizes that raw documents and data need some contextualization, and that is very well supplied by organizations like The Guardian, like The Times. At the same time, I believe they've achieved a lot more publicity in this situation than previous efforts, precisely because they've roped organizations in.
By the whistleblower website, WikiLeaks.org.
By working with mainstream media outlets, the New York Times, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel, WikiLeaks got more than just publicity, it got some political cover. Some have said that the whistleblowing site represents the future of journalism. However, WikiLeaks has a reputation amongst the political and media establishments as a rogue element.
I'm a combative person, so I like crushing bastards.
Releasing that Iraq war video in March and calling it collateral murder reinforced that view. But by hooking up with mainstream outlets and tapping into their media brands, WikiLeaks has shielded itself from that kind of criticism.
WikiLeaks didn't just release documents out there into the ether for everyone to report on or not report on. WikiLeaks actually went to major news sources and worked with them on this. So the White House couldn't say, you can't trust this, because the New York Times obviously trusted them.
The collaboration was The Guardian's idea, after the paper learned WikiLeaks had the documents and was preparing to release them.
We decided that the information would make more sense. It would have more impact. There would be more protection for everybody involved if we created this unique collaboration, which The Guardian would set up a secret research room in this building and bring in the New York Times and Der Spiegel, and we would work together analyzing this vast database.
The publications took different editorial approaches. Der Spiegel talked up the WikiLeaks angle, as did The Guardian, which interviewed Julian Assange for its website.
If journalism is good, it is controversial by its nature.
The Times kept WikiLeaks references to a minimum. And there were marked differences in the tone of the reporting. The Guardian, which opposes the war, led with a huge cache of secret U.S. military files. Today provides a devastating portrait of the failing war in Afghanistan, revealing how coalition forces have killed hundreds of civilians in unreported incidents. Der Spiegel said, never before has it been possible to compare the reality on the battlefield in such a detailed manner with what the U.S. Army propaganda machinery is propagating. The New York Times' lead was more measured. It called the archives an unvarnished, ground-level picture of the war that is in many respects more grim than the official portrayal. A daily diary of an American-led force often starved for resources and an insurgency that grew larger and more deadly each year. And whereas The Guardian and Der Spiegel focused on civilian casualties and the coalition's military setbacks, The Times zeroed in on suggestions that Pakistan and Iran are fueling the insurgency. The Times also ran its story past the Obama administration before publishing it. The paper's Washington bureau chief told Yahoo.com, "I did go to the White House and lay out for them what we had to give them the opportunity to comment and react. They did. They also praised us for the way we handled it and for handling the information with care and for being responsible."
Did they try to have their cake and eat it too at the New York Times? I'd say that going to the White House and clearing these papers, giving them a heads up, was due diligence. When you're dealing with material like this, it is important to run it by some sort of authority and make sure there isn't anything sensitive or that's going to endanger people out in the field.
WikiLeaks says it too held back documents for security reasons. Journalists who have studied the site say otherwise, that informants and Afghans working with coalition forces have been identified and are now endangered.
Was ist WikiLeaks eigentlich ganz genau?
As for this new model media coalition, WikiLeaks' flirtation with mainstream outlets is not yet a marriage, but the Warlog story proves there are exciting possibilities for journalism. Three old media dynasties with expertise to offer, courting a new media darling, coveting her online dowry full of raw data, raw news material.
WikiLeaks chose the old media to publicize this for the reason that by flattering the old media, you get media attention. That's how, like, actual politicians play the New York Times, and that's how newsmakers have used the newspapers and the mainstream media. And it works. It's tried and true, and that's why WikiLeaks was smart to do it that way.
And just because three major publications have exploited the WikiLeaks documents, that doesn't mean the story's dead. Far from it.
Other journalists and researchers will now get their chance to look through this material. They'll have a chance to put it on a timeline, look at what else was around when these documents were written. And I think that there will be revelations coming out of this in the weeks and months to come.
Our Global Village Voice is now with their take on the latest revelations from WikiLeaks.
The WikiLeaks release about Afghanistan is central to understanding what that war has become. Julian Assange, the co-founder, has done what journalism should be doing, namely finding, sourcing and releasing information about a war that affects us all.
I wonder those who question or criticize the leak of classified information, how they ignored the killings of thousands of innocent civilians in an unaccountable war.
WikiLeaks is gradually winning a PR campaign against the Pentagon and presenting itself consistently as a credible source of alternative information. And in the long run, that will probably prove to be more damaging than any specific information that it gives out at any one time.
It's time now for Listening Post News Bites. A coalition of media outlets in the United States has demanded that the Pentagon revise its rules for reporting on Guantanamo Bay. A group consisting of the news agency, the Associated Press, as well as the New York Times and the Miami Herald, amongst others, wants the restrictions eased. They've been an issue ever since the military commissions began and flared up once again in May when four reporters were banned for publishing the name of an interrogator who had already been named in hundreds of news reports.
These individual reporters are barred from returning to cover future military commissions proceedings.
Three of those reporters are Canadians: Michelle Shepherd of the Toronto Star, Stephen Edwards of Can West, and Paul Coring of the Globe and Mail. The fourth reporter is Carol Rosenberg of the Miami Herald. The name of that interrogator, by the way, is Joshua Klaus. That's spelled C-L-A-U-S. Another potentially troubling development in Iraq for the freedom of the media there. The country's Supreme Judicial Court has announced plans to create a new court whose sole function would be to try media cases in areas such as defamation and libel. That announcement has set off alarm bells at organizations like the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists, which says, quote, a specialized press court is hardly the solution. Historically, special press courts have been used for restriction rather than protection, unquote. Iraq's Journalistic Freedoms Observatory says the court is, quote, a move to control the media, unquote. It suggests the creation of such a legal body would in fact be unconstitutional since Article 92 of the Iraqi Constitution forbids the establishment of special or exceptional courts under any circumstances. Score one for Rupert Murdoch in his legal battle with Silvio Berlusconi over access to the Italian digital television market. The European Commission has ruled that Murdoch Sky Italia can now apply for one of Italy's digital TV frequencies. That move was opposed by the Italian Prime Minister's company, Mediaset. Mediaset has argued the Italian market is not big enough for more competition and said it will appeal the ruling. Between the channels that he owns and the state-owned channels that he effectively controls, Silvio Berlusconi has his hands on six of Italy's seven terrestrial TV outlets. We'll have more on Rupert Murdoch in part two of our program. Note to the accident-prone petroleum giant, BP. If a blogger who claims that he is no pro at Photoshop can tell that you've been doctoring images on your website, then you probably shouldn't be doing it. This is a photo that was posted on BP's site from the company's command center in Houston. It shows multiple screens monitoring the cleanup operations in the Gulf of Mexico. But someone at AmericaBlog.com saw that something wasn't quite right. Since then, BP has admitted that this is the original photo in which three of the screens are blank. BP's explanation, they said the shot was the work of some contract photographer, a bit like the company's initial reaction to the oil spill itself.
The drilling rig was a Transocean drilling rig. It was their rig and their equipment that failed, run by their people with their processes.
Some corporations, when dealing with the media, never learn. We're back after the break with a piece on those online newspapers that you like to read for free and the media baron who's out to change all that. Welcome back. When you read the web edition of your favorite newspaper, do you ever wonder how the paper can afford to give away its content online? Well, the short answer is it cannot. The pennies that publishers get from advertisers every time you visit are not enough to pay the bills. And that's why News Corp's Rupert Murdoch says it's time to cut you off. On July 1st, Murdoch began charging for online access to the Times of London, £1 per day, about $1.50 or $3 per week. Now, industry analysts say that the initial unofficial numbers are not encouraging for Murdoch, that in the first month of his paywall, the Times has lost about 90% of its web readers. And part of Murdoch's problem is that he's got to convince other publishers to do the same thing he's doing, because given the choice, newspaper readers are likely to take the free option rather than pay for access. The Listening Post's Jason Mojica now on Rupert Murdoch, his paywall, and an experiment that may well shape the future of journalism on the web.
Is that really your idea of how to run a newspaper?
I don't know how to run a newspaper, Mr. Thatcher. I just try everything I can think of.
It's 1941, and a classic American movie tells the story of a hard-headed newspaper owner trying to succeed against seemingly impossible odds.
You're right, Mr. Thatcher. I did lose $1 million last year. I expect to lose $1 million this year. I expect to lose $1 million next year. You know, Mr. Thatcher, at the rate of $1 million a year, I'll have to close this place in 60 years.
These days, many an American newspaper owner would be relieved to lose $1 million annually. Last year alone, advertising revenues for U.S. papers dropped by $7.5 billion. But like his cinematic predecessor, News Corp's Rupert Murdoch has both the audacity and the money to ignore the critics and do things his own way.
Well, Rupert Murdoch has never been a popular guy. I mean, he's always gone his own way. A lot of the journalism that he produced in his early years was pretty awful. You know, Murdoch knows how to make money. He's proven that over a very long lifetime in the news business.
Newspapers in North America and Western Europe have been in decline for years, with both advertisers and readers turning to the internet. The onset of the global recession has only made it worse.
The Rocky Mountain News stopped its presses at the end of February. That's after 150 years. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer fell right behind.
Each passing week seems to bring another round of newsroom layoffs, another round of bankruptcies.
Everywhere, jobs are being shed, printworks are closing, newsrooms are merging.
In 2009, Murdoch decided it was time to take action and announced plans to charge for access to the online versions of the more than 175 titles owned by News Corp worldwide.
How do we make sure that people pay for the online content?
Simple. You turn them off. They've got a sign on. They give you your credit card number. And that's it.
Is it really that easy? The Financial Times and Murdoch's Wall Street Journal have made paid content work, but they're the newspaper equivalent of a private club, tools of the financial trade.
The readers of the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal see buying a newspaper or subscribing to a newspaper online as a business expense. That's not true of a general interest newspaper. There isn't any professional requirement or any other kind of requirement for an ordinary reader to buy a newspaper like the London Times.
That's exactly the reason why no established generalist newspaper has ever put a paywall up around all of its content. Until now. The launch of the Times' new website takes Murdoch into uncharted waters.
Other newspapers have tried these very kind of permeable sort of walls around their content. They will allow people to see certain amounts of articles for free and then pay for some. I think the new site that we've built is very, very clear. If you want to read Times Journalism online, you pay for it. And we've been selling Times Journalism for 225 years in print, and we don't think it's actually that strange, the idea that people are going to pay for that on different platforms.
So how many of the people who buy the Times at the newsstand or who've gotten used to reading it online for free can be expected to fork over the $1.50 a day or $3 a week to keep reading? A London-based company called Entertainment Media Research found that fewer than 10% of consumers would be willing to pay for Times content online. Initial data seems to confirm that.
My user behavior when I'm searching for something is I'm like a bee. I'm in a field of flowers. I want to sniff over here. I want to sniff over there. I'm on the hunt for nectar. If I come across a paywall, I'm not going to pay for it so that I can access it. I'm simply going to go somewhere else. There's so much content.
One of the ways I look at it is a bit like Oxford Street in London. There are hundreds of thousands of people walk down Oxford Street every hour, but I'm not that interested in people walking past. I'm interested in people coming into the shop buying what I have.
But what is it exactly that Rupert Murdoch is selling?
People used to go to a newspaper for a lot of different things, crossword puzzles, comics, sports, all kinds of things other than the major news of the day. Now you can get a lot of that kind of information or services or entertainment in other places on the web. And so it's not a matter of the whole thing being a self-contained package that you are willing to pay for just for the crossword puzzle, for example. But the pattern of decline is simply inevitable. It is just logical to believe that you have to find a way to create a new business model in which you draw revenue from what you put online.
The New York Times and other newspaper websites have experimented with allowing access to a limited number of articles or charging only for premium content. The model the Times of London has chosen is all or nothing. Could this no-nonsense approach be the way forward for the industry, or will it miss the mark with the web generation, those of us who have grown accustomed to getting news for free?
I think paywalls as a blanket solution are a bad idea. I think throwing all the content behind the paywall, as the Times has done, is very short-sighted. And I think that users won't stick around. I think the right approach for publishers is to look at the changing landscape and to put together a solution that's based on that, not on old thinking. Murdoch's approach is based on thinking that worked 50 years ago. It doesn't work now.
But Rupert Murdoch has made a fortune and created a media empire by defying conventional wisdom. He moved scores of money-losing papers around the world into the black by gutting staff. He's busted press unions in the UK, and his Fox News channel in the US calls itself fair and balanced when it's anything but. He doesn't just ignore criticism, he seems to thrive on it. And the paywall idea looks like just the latest example of it.
He's one tough old coot in the big journalism game, But if he thinks he's onto something and he's correct, every editor and every publisher in the industrialized world will make some attempt to follow him and the New York Times if both of these things work.
More Global Village Voices now on newspaper paywalls.
When it comes to paywalls, it's just going to be interesting to see whether the Times manages to pull this off and convince its readers that they want to pay for something that previously has been free and very easy to access. They've been quite brave by being the first national newspaper in the UK to do this.
Every news editor in the land is going to be watching what happens to the Times very closely over the next few months, and I'm sure many will be tempted to follow suit, but in my opinion, they'd be foolish to do that. The solution to this problem isn't hiding your content behind a paywall, it's producing a product that serves a need your audience has.
Finally, the whole iPhone 4 antenna thing. Owners of Apple's new phone are complaining that if they hold the handset the wrong way, the phone tends to lose its signal. The company's doing what it can to at least correct the negative publicity, but now it's up against a viral force. Russell Arch is a director, a writer, and an animator who lives in Los Angeles, and he's posted an animated clip on YouTube about the iPhone's issues. The video imagines what would happen if a frustrated Sith Lord ever called Apple's customer support unit looking for help with his phone. The video's racking up a lot of hits on the web. We've made it our web video of the week. We'll see you next time at the Listening Post.
It's a wonderful day. Thanks for calling. This is Wendy. How may I help you?
You're
speaking of Wendy,
my bad.
Sir?
Just killing some time while I was on hold.
Not a problem. So what can I do for you today?
Yeah, I just got a couple of questions about my iPhone 4 and the whole antenna issue.
Absolutely, sir. The facts are that all phones have problems when gripped, and it's also true that the iPhone 4 drops less than one additional call per 100 than the previous iPhone 3GS.
Whoa. First off, you know, I watched the press conference last week, so you can stop reading from your whole little script there. And second, are you seriously defending the new phone by saying it almost performs as well as the old phone? Is that what the plan is?
Sir?
I think at this point we all know it's a design issue, and that is fine, but just admit it!
Sir, it's not a design flaw. The fact is that all phones have reception problems from time to time.
I'm sorry.
It's possible you're in a low signal area.
I shouldn't be. I mean, I even put in a whole cell phone tower right down by the vending machines. Oh, let's see, you take the original phone, remove the physical keyboard, make it as big as a toaster, and still don't add a front-facing camera? Yeah, that's progress.
Sir, not sure how to help you.
Do you have any ETA on when I might get my free bumper case?
No.